Prides. An essay on writing workshops. This piece was a contribution to a volume edited by Paul M. Wrigley and Debbie Cross as a benefit for the Susan Petrie Fund and Clarion West Writers' Workshop in 1989. This version is different here and there, updated, but the illustrations are the same. Sometimes I worry about workshops. I've taught quite a few. Clarion West 4 times. In Australia, at Haystack on the Oregon coast, and at the Malheur Field Station in the Oregon desert. At the Indiana and Bennington Writers' Conferences, at the Writing Centers in D.C., and at Portland State University. And many times at the beloved and much missed Flight of the Mind. And I still teach workshops sometimes, though sometimes I think I should stop. Not only because I am getting old and lazy, but because I'm two-minded about workshops, not single-minded. I worry, are they a good thing? Yes? No? I always come down on the yes side, lightly, but with both feet. A workshop can certainly do harm as well as good. The most harmless harm it can do is waste time. This happens when people come to it expecting to teach or be taught how to write. If you think you can teach people how to write, you're wasting their time. And if they think you can teach them how to write, they're wasting yours, and vice, as it were, versa. People attending workshops are not learning how to write. What they are learning or doing, as I understand it, will come up later on. A more harmful harm that can infect the workshop is the ego trip. Classes in literary writing and writers' conferences years ago were mostly ego trips, the great author and his disciples. A good deal of that still goes on at prestigious universities and creative writing programs featuring pickled big names. It was the system of mutual group criticism, the Clarion system, now used almost everywhere writing is taught, that freed the pedagogy of writing from hierarchical authority and authorial hierarchy. But even in a mutual criticism workshop, the instructor can go on an ego trip. I have known an instructor who ran an amateur Esalen, playing mind games and deliberately disintegrating participants' personalities without the faintest idea of how to put them back together. I have known an instructor who ran a little Devil's Island, punishing the participants for writing by trashing their work, except for a favorite trustee or two who got smarmed over. I have known an instructor, oh, many, too many, who ran a little Paris Island, where a week of systematic misogyny was supposed to result in a few good men. I have known instructors who seemed to be running for a popularity prize, and instructors who just ran away, leaving their students to flounder, not showing up from Monday until Friday when they came to collect their check. Such self-indulgence can do real and permanent damage, particularly when the instructor is famous and respected and the participant is, and they all are, more or less, insecure and vulnerable. To offer one's work for criticism is an act of trust requiring real courage. It must be respected as such. I know several people who, after a brutal dismissal by a writer they admired, stopped writing for years, one of them forever. Certainly a writing instructor has a responsibility to defend the art and the right to set very high standards. But nobody has the right to stop a person from trying to learn. The defense of excellence has nothing whatever to do with bullying. Ego-tripping by participants can also be destructive to the work of other individuals or of the whole group. Unless the instructor is savvy enough to refuse to play games with the troublemaker, who is usually either a manipulative bully or a passive bully, a psychopathically demanding person. I was slow to learn that as the instructor, I must refuse to collude with these people. I'm still not good at handling them, but have found that if I ask other participants to help me, they do so, often with a skill, kindness, and psychological sensitivity that never cease to amaze me. Perhaps all workshops should have a sign on the door, "Do not feed the ego," but then on the other side of the door should be a sign, "Do not feed the altruist," because the practice of any art is impeded by both egoism and altruism. What's needed is concentration on the work. I shall now go out on a limb, hunch my shoulders, clack my beak, stare fiercely, and announce that I think there are two types of workshop that are, to some extent, intrinsically harmful. Both types tend to corrupt the work. They do it differently, but are alike in using writing not as an end, but as a means. I will call them commercial and establishmentarian. Commercially oriented workshops and conferences range from the modest kind, where everybody is dying to meet the New York editor and the agent who sells in six figures, and nothing is talked about but markets, good markets for paragraphs, good markets for religious and uplift, and so on, to the fancy kind, where everybody sneers at little old ladies who write paragraphs but would kill to meet the same editor and the same agent, and where nothing is talked about but markets, meeting contacts, finding an agent with some smarts, series sales, and so on. All these matters of business are of legitimate, immediate, and necessary interest to a writer. Writers need to learn their trade and how to negotiate the increasingly difficult marketplace. The trade can be taught and learned just as the craft can, but a workshop where the trade is the principal focus of interest is not a writing workshop. It is a business class. If success in selling is my primary interest, I am not primarily a writer, but a salesperson. If I teach success in selling as the writer's primary objective, I am not teaching writing. I'm teaching, or pretending to teach, the production and marketing of a commodity. Establishmentarian workshops and programs, on the other hand, eschew low talk of marketing. Sell is a four-letter word at such places. You go to them to be in the right place where you'll meet the right people. The purpose of such programs, most of which are in the eastern half of the United States, is to feed an in-group or elite, the innermost members of which go to the innermost writers' colonies and get the uppermost grants by recommending one another. If being perceived as a successful writer is my primary interest, I am not primarily a writer, but a social climber, a person using certain paraliterary ploys to attain a certain kind of prestige. If I teach these techniques in a workshop, I am not teaching writing, but methods of joining an elite. It is to be noticed that membership in the elite may, not incidentally, improves one's chances to sell work in the marketplace. There's always a well-kept road between the marketplace and the really nice part of town. Papa Hemingway said that writers write for money, and Papa Freud said that artists work for fame, money, and the love of women. I'll leave out the love of women, though it would be much more fun to talk about. Fame and money, success and power. If you agree with the papas, there are workshops for you, but this is not the essay for you. I think both papas were talking through their hats. I don't think writers write for either fame or money, though they love them when they can get them. Writers don't write for anything, not even for art's sake. They write. Singers sing, dancers dance, writers write. The whole question of what a thing is for has no more to do with art than it has to do with babies or forests or galaxies. In a money economy, artists must sell their work or be supported by gifts while doing it. Since our national government is hysterically suspicious of all artists, and most arts foundations are particularly stingy to writers, North American writers must be directly concerned with the skills of marketing and grant-getting. They need to learn their trade. There are many guidebooks and organizations to help them learn it, but the trade is not the art. Writers and teachers of writing who put saleability before quality degrade the writer and the work. Writing workshops that put marketing and contact-making before quality degrade the art. If you don't agree with me, that's fine. Just keep out of my workshop. Finally, one more cause of time-wasting, workshop codependency, the policy of encouraging eternal returners, workshop junkies, people who go to retreats and groups year after year but don't write anything the rest of the year. and the policy of giving a grant simply because the applicant has received other grants to attend other workshops and writers' colonies. A friend who is at one of the very elite New England artist colonies told me about a woman there who had no address. She lived at colonies and conferences. She had published 2 short stories in the last 10 years. She was a professional, all right, but her profession was not writing. Junkies always bring an old manuscript to the workshop, and when it gets criticized, they tell us about the great writers at greater workshops who said how great it was. If the instructor demands new work from junkies, they are outraged. But I've been working on this since 1950. Bearded with moss and in garments green, indistinct in the twilight, they will be hauling out that same damned unfinished manuscript 20 years from now and whining, "But Longfellow said it was tremendously sensitive." But then I am a workshop junkie, too. I keep doing them. Why? So, to the positive side, maybe nobody can teach anybody how to write, but just as techniques for attaining profit and prestige can be taught in the commercial and establishmentarian programs, so realistic expectations, useful habits, respect for the art, and respect for oneself as a writer can be acquired in work-centered workshops. What the instructor has to give is, I think, above all, experience. Whether rationalized and verbalized, or just shared by being there, being a writer, reading the work, talking about the work. What most participants need most is to learn to think of themselves as writers. For the young, this is all too often no problem at all. Many teenagers, college-agers, having no idea what being a fiction writer entails, assume they can write novels and screenplays and play drums in a band and pass their GREs and 15 other things at the same time, no sweat. This blithe attitude is healthy, it is endearing, and it means they do not belong in a serious workshop, or, in my opinion, in a writing program ending in a degree of any kind. The very young cannot, except in rare cases, make the commitment that is required. With many adults, the problem is the opposite, lack of confidence. Women, particularly women with children or in middle age and older, may find it enormously difficult to take seriously anything they do that isn't done for other people, the altruism trap. Men brought up to consider themselves as wage earners and ordinary Joes may in the same way find it hard to take the leap to considering themselves seriously as writers. And this is why, though peer groups of amateur and semi-amateur writers are a wonderful development of the last decades, and though the functioning of the workshop is strictly egalitarian, the workshop has an instructor, a central figure who is a professional, a real, indubitable, published writer, able to share professionalism and lend reality as a writer to everyone in the circle. And thus it is important that instructors should not be writing teachers, but writers teaching, people who have published professionally and actively in the field of the workshop. And it is important that they should be women as often as they are men. If they are Gathenians, this latter requirement is no problem. Otherwise, it should be a central concern of the workshop managers. Instructors are not only symbols and gurus. They are directly useful. Their assignments, directions, discussions, exercises, criticisms, responses, and fits of temperament allow the participants to discover that they can meet a deadline, write a short story overnight, try a new form, take a risk, discover gifts they didn't know they had. The instructor directs their practice. Practice is an interesting word. We think of practicing as beginner's stuff, playing scales, basic exercises. But the practice of an art is the doing of that art. It is the art. When the participants have been practicing writing with a bunch of other practicing writers for a week, they can feel with some justification that they are, in fact, writers. So perhaps the essence of a workshop that works is the group itself. The instructor facilitates the formation of the group, but the circle of people is the source of energy. It is, by the way, important that it be literally, insofar as possible, a a circle. This is the TP theory of workshopping. A circle of units is not a hierarchy. It is one shape made of many. One whole, one thing. Participants who participate, who write, read, criticize, and discuss are learning a great deal. First of all, they're learning to take criticism, learning that they can take criticism, negative, positive, aggressive, constructive, valuable, stupid, they can take it. Most of us can, but we don't think we can till we do, and the fear of it can be crippling. To find that you have been roundly criticized and yet have gone on writing, that frees up a lot of energy. Participants are also learning to read other people's writing and criticize it responsibly. For a good many, this is the first real reading they've ever done. Reading not as passive absorption, as in reading junk for relaxation and escape. Reading not as detached intellectual analysis, as in English 102, but reading as the intensely active and only partially intellectual process of collaboration with a text. A workshop in which one person learned to read that way would have justified itself. But if the group forms, everybody begins reading each other's work that way, and often real reading is so exciting to those new to it that it leads to the overvaluation of texts that is one of the minor hazards of a lively workshop. Learning to read gives people a whole new approach to writing. They have learned to read what they write. They can turn their critico-collaborative skills onto their own work and so be enabled to revise constructively, without dreading revision as a destructive process or a never-ending one, as many inexperienced writers do. I spoke of the psychological acuteness and sensitivity I have learned to count on and call on in workshop groups. I think it rises from the fact that the people feel that they are working hard together at hard work, and that they have experienced honesty and trust as absolutely essential to getting the work done. So they will use all their skills to achieve that honesty and trust. If the group works as a group, everyone in it, including the instructor, is strengthened by its community and exhilarated by its energy. This is such a rare and valuable experience that it's no wonder good workshops almost always spin off into small peer groups that may go on working together for months or years. And it's one reason why I go on teaching. I come home from a workshop and I write. The writer, that noble, heroic figure gazing at a blank page, who is such an awful bore in books and movies because he doesn't get to bash holes in marble or slash brushes over canvas or conduct gigantic orchestras or die playing Hamlet. He only gets to gaze and drink and mope and crumple up sheets of paper and throw them at a wastebasket, which is just as boring as what he does in real life, which is he sits there and he sits there and he sits there, and if you say anything, he jumps and shouts, "What?" The writer, I say, is not only boring, but lonely, even when, perhaps especially when, her family, she has changed sex like Orlando, is with her, asking, "Where's my blue shirt? When is dinner?" The writer is liable to feel like a little tiny person all alone in a desert where the sand is words. Giant figures of bestsellers and great authors loom over her like statues. "Look on my works, you puny," and despair. This lonely, sitting-there person may find that in a work-centered workshop, she can draw on the kind of group support and collaborative rivalry, the pooled energy that actors, dancers, and musicians, all performing artists, draw on all the time. And so long as ego-tripping is discouraged, the process of the workshop, depending on mutual aid, stimulation, emulation, honesty, and trust, can produce an unusually pure and clear form of that energy. The participant may be able to carry some of that energy home, not having learned how to write, but having learned what it is to write. I think of a good workshop as a pride of lions at a waterhole. They all hunt zebras all night, and then they all eat the zebra, growling a good deal, and then they all come to the waterhole to drink together. Then, in the heat of the day, they lie around rumbling and swatting flies and looking benevolent. It is something to have belonged, even for a week, to a pride of lions.